Good morning, good people, and welcome to the Pool Proof Wisdom Podcast, Conversations. I'm Charles K. Poole, your host. Today is the 1st of May, and also the beginning of Mental Health Awareness Month. Now, before you think that's just another month, consider this. According to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, each year, millions of Americans face the reality of living with a mental illness. So, during Mental Health Awareness Month, the organization joins others in fighting stigma, providing support, educating the public, and advocating for policies that support people managing mental illness and the people who care for them. Mental health matters to me because I know how much work and effort it takes to find balance and hope in a world that often considers anyone dealing with emotional or other issues a target rather than someone in need of help and support. Now, if you need any proof of that and what just a challenge mental health can be, think back to the last year and what we've all been dealing with as we've been enduring a pandemic. If you know what that feels like, you get a good sense of what it can be like for those who suffer from mental challenges every day. The fight for mental health is real, and if you didn't know it, well, now you do. My guests today are in the service of providing help to those who need it. Tom Duff and Debbie Dugan are with St. Louis Counseling, a nonprofit professional counseling agency that provides services within the Archdiocese of St. Louis, including individual, group, and family counseling. They make no distinctions between anyone whatsoever. They help everyone. Tom is a licensed clinical social worker and executive director at St. Louis Counseling and brings more than 25 years of mental health expertise to his role. We'll talk more about that experience in a bit. Debbie is the agency's business development and marketing director. And while not a mental health professional herself, her personal knowledge of why mental health matters informs her work and commitment to it. We'll also talk a bit more about that later on. By the way, she's also a former classmate of mine and a very good friend. And by the way, both of them are very fine people. Good morning and welcome to the podcast, Tom and Debbie. So let's start today with the appropriate question. How are both of you today?
Doing well.
I am splendid. The sun is shining here in beautiful St. Louis. So yeah, I'm feeling good.
This is a good thing. And once we get started on the perspectives that we're going to be sharing here today, I think that this is going to be quite an interesting show. Two very good people, two different personalities, and of course me. What else could you ask for? It's a party already.
Totally.
Okay. So what we're doing is we're kicking off Mental Health Awareness Month. Very, very important. And given that I have appeared on your podcast for St. Louis Counseling before, it's very clear to me the passion and the commitment you both share to this particular issue. So, of course, my first question as we kick off this month is, what is Mental Health Awareness Month in terms of what it means to you? And why should it be something everyone considers important?
You know, for me, I'll go ahead and jump in. For me, it's a whole month, right? And so we all have different months that we celebrate for various different aspects of our worlds and honoring certain individuals and things of that nature. But Mental Health Awareness Month for me is like, man, a whole month where we can make it okay to talk about. And to preach it almost, to say like, hey, let's talk about mental health around the dinner table. Why? Because it's the month we're supposed to, but maybe we form a habit, right? Mm-hmm. And we form that habit and to make it just okay to share. And I think that's a huge part for me.
So when you're looking at this from your perspective, Debbie, how do you chime in on that?
I would say the same. And especially with COVID, I think people are so much more aware of how their mental health has been affected by COVID, whether they had it or not, but just even the isolation, the quarantines, everything, you know, it's been a whole year. So I think people are really thirsting for something to help them get through this next phase of where we are and what all those feelings and all those situations that they had, how they can identify it and what they can do to move past and move through and hopefully this will really help.
I think that requires a little bit of a deep dive, because let's talk about it. I think that before the year plus that we're looking at over the course of this pandemic so far, most people thought when it was a question of mental health, that was something that applied to other people. But interestingly, as a result of going through what so many have gone through, they've discovered, guess what? My mental health is affected by having to wear a mask, having to stay in my house, having to do everything that is the antithesis of what I'm used to doing. Do you think that that came as a surprise to folks, and why?
You know, for me, it's, and people have heard me say it before, is, you know, we all have mental health, just like we all have physical health. Some people have a mental illness. And so I think pre-pandemic, pre-COVID, people still were very set on, well, mental health means mental illness. I don't have depression. I don't have anxiety. I don't have bipolar. And I think now people are like, wow, when I was home alone and I had to work from home, I started feeling really kind of bad. I started feeling sluggish. I started feeling uninspired. Why? Because I wasn't having that interaction every day in the office. I couldn't walk past the person's individual cubicle and say hi. I lost some of that. So I think that people, it was this, like you said, this awakening, so to speak, that my ebb and flow of mental health can really start down a pattern of more of a downside. And you know, until I take control, or whoever the individual is, take control and make some intervention, is when I can start feeling better again. So it was kind of a rude awakening for some, I think.
So, Tom, you have experience as a professional therapist, and from what I understand, your expertise is in high-stress crisis situations. How did you find, as you've now been able to sit back, perhaps, and look at the year plus, this has impacted people beyond their expectations, in addition to what you're saying? I mean, in very direct ways. Are there any experiences that you can tap into on that?
Yeah, I think when, you know, when you talk about high stress situations and then prolonged high stress situation, and that's what we ran into during this year, whether it be people that were grieving because of they lost the loved ones. But I really think about the healthcare worker, right? And the healthcare worker who's inside these COVID units, or even maybe not a COVID unit, just a hospital, right? Just a regular floor in a hospital, that was an ongoing stressful event, you know, and at times we call that toxic stress in that sense. When you work or live in an environment that is constantly provoking the chemicals in your brain to be on high alert status, it pushes you to a limit. And a lot of times they don't feel until they can actually decompress. And I think with a lot of our healthcare workers, they're starting to come out of it, depending on the location where you live, you know, across the United States. So now they might take a few days off in a row, and they might be able to go, oh, and then all of a sudden they start experiencing like, wait, I feel sad all of a sudden. I'm allowing myself to feel. And I think that's where the mental health side and the mental health crisis to the pandemic comes into play. Because now when we breathe and take several different breaths, we feel.
I see. And Debbie, given that you have been admittedly not a professional in this regard, but you have dealt with some personal matters when it comes to protecting and preserving your own mental health, particularly when it comes to the area of anxiety, I understand. Talk to me from that perspective in terms of the work that the agency does, how you feel as someone who has had to deal with this in a very individual way.
Yeah, it's really been cathartic in a lot of ways. I think, you know, when you're going through, like Tom was saying, when you're going through situations that you're in the throes of it, and you're trying to navigate, whether it's your own anxiety, your own depression, you're trying to navigate it, you're trying to make sense of it, you're trying not to be a burden. Or on the opposite side, if you're a caregiver and you're trying to be supportive but not enabling, and you're trying to help everybody who's at a different place with what they're experiencing when it's going on. So, you know, for example, and my husband was extremely generous in saying, talk about whatever you need to talk about with this, because he really wants it to help people. But so he had severe depression that waned and waxed and waned probably, well, it's been several years, but recently over a year and a half, and he wasn't able to work at all at different times. So both of my boys, I only have two kids. They're both adults. They helped with his business with lawn care, and they kind of took it over and did the work for him and kept it sustained. And I know that, you know, the stress that we were all feeling and what my husband was going through, there were times when I really didn't quite know what I was doing and what was going to work and what was going to be best to help him get motivated to move forward while also trying to keep my sanity going and help the boys understand that, you know, they're not responsible for this, that, you know, if they choose to help my husband with the business, great, but that's not their primary role in all of this. And so being in a place where mental health matters are truly understood and understanding that it's not just the person going through it who's impacted, that it impacts everybody, that it was significant. I love social workers. I love counselors. There's just there's an understanding about humanity that just really is a support to people when they're going through different situations. And I wouldn't have been able to do it either without counseling myself. You know, there were a lot of things that I did wrong, you know, from the beginning. And whether it was with my husband or our younger son also struggled a lot with anxiety and ADHD and different issues. He also said it was okay to talk about it. There were so many things that I don't know how to do it. I'm a mom and I want to learn, but I don't always have the words or the right way of handling things. So it's been a learning experience. And the good news is that there are coping skills, there are strategies, there are different things that everybody can do to make it all come together. And when it's a family member, it's the entire family who's impacted. And we all have to learn what works for us and also make sure that we're taking care of ourselves as we're going through it on both ends.
Okay. Thank you. Let's talk a little bit, and both of you can weigh in on this. That's very important, I think, to make a distinction about, because so often when we're talking about mental health, there's this perspective, this perception that there's something wrong with the person. And therefore, those people who are in their families, in their lives, and whatever, who are trying to find a way of being of assistance, I noticed that you said that you didn't do the right things. That becomes a burden to bear as well, because you feel like you're not doing something that's in support of the people you love. When you're looking at that from a clinical standpoint, I know that that's very finite. But on a day-to-day basis, when you're trying to figure out how to be of assistance while at the same time making the other person realize that they're still okay, you talked about strategies and tactics and plans that you can use. Do you have any examples of that that you might be willing to speak to, either of you?
I mean, I think right off the bat, we have to give ourselves, as well as others, but with this example, we have to give ourselves grace and understanding. And grace is such a sometimes difficult term to define, because it means, you know, each person kind of looks at it differently, but it's okay to not be perfect. It's okay to mess up. It's okay to not always, you know, do everything the way society dictates to us at times on what is the correct way. So when I say that, you know, we have to give ourselves grace, that means we actually have to stop during our day and think about that. And sometimes that means scheduling some self-time, some self-thought without your phone, without the TV, without everything else going on. and to allow yourself to be able to say, like, you know what, I'm not perfect. I can hold myself to really high standards. You know, I'm not saying that, you know, hold yourself to the standards you want to, but if you don't achieve those, you can't beat yourself up. So a lot of times that's where I start, you know, with myself, as well as if, as a clinician, I would start with people there as well.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank
you. Yeah. I would also add that, it's really easy, and especially from a parent perspective, to blame yourself when it's your child, especially like, oh my God, what did I do wrong that made this happen? And like Tom said, to give yourself the grace to realize that things happen. You know, life is what it is, and not everything that goes on is a direct result of something. It's, you know, we're born a certain way, the chemicals in our brain might be off. So there are just different things that can contribute to what's going on. So that grace, I think, is huge. I think being able to talk to people about the situation is an enormous help and support. You can't carry that by yourself. It's just too heavy. And to have people who really understand, even if they haven't lived through it, but they're willing to listen and just help you just to get it out and to talk about honestly the frustrations and the exasperation that you might be feeling. And sometimes there is a sense of, oh my gosh, is this ever going to change? Mm-hmm. You know, like what is this going to be our life for the rest of our lives? And what, how am I going to do this? If it is, I don't even, you know, expressing that and getting that out and really leaning on people. And if they're offering to help, take them up on it and not be ashamed that this has happened. I think that's a really big thing that society throws at people too, is this whole piece of shame, right? That, you know, you're not doing this right. And I would do it so much differently and better than you're doing. And what's wrong with you? I ran into that on different occasions, and it's hurtful. It's not helpful. So I think when people are expressing what's going on in their lives and the difficulties that they're facing, and Tom talks about this all the time on podcasts and different situations, but we have to listen. We really have to be willing to meet the person where they are and not judge what we think they should be doing, but to really listen to what's happening. And even if that means just sitting with them and not having an answer, we don't always have answers, but just to be able to be with that person and be present is enormous.
Right. I think that it's really important to remember that one of the most difficult things there is fighting for the right to be who you are. I think that's a challenge no matter who the person is. Now, I happen to practice what I call intensive self-care. The reason I do that is, coming up as I have, I learned early on, perhaps some would say too early, the importance of knowing who you are to such an extent that others don't necessarily influence how you perceive what is your right, your wrong, your in-between. When it comes to mental health, for me, that is somewhat of a protection against all of the influences there are out there, driven by so many things from social media to just a lot of other factors that we don't have control over. When we're talking about mental health, we're looking at it as well in terms of mental health in this country right now, coming out of a pandemic, coming out of all of these issues related to race relations, misogyny, you name it, all the things that are going on. I call them the evil isms because they all compel people to believe that they're not enough, or that there's something wrong with them, and that if other people don't believe that they are of a value that matters, they shouldn't believe it themselves. So in that regard, when I am looking at the question of mental health, isn't it a lot broader than just those elements that say how you feel from day to day, but instead are focused on what you are trying to do to become who you are intended to be from your perspective? Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah, you know, because what you're describing is a person's spirit, right?
Right.
It's a person's spirit and who you are and how you're made up. And, you know, all those are factors that play into it. But it's like this ability to reach in and become and to know thyself. That's a term I use a lot, right? But to know thyself, but to reach in there and figure out who that is. And then it's getting comfortable in your own skin. So, you know, when you talk about counseling, when you talk about therapy and going to a therapist, that's ultimately what we're kind of molding, right? So yes, do we have specific interventions that we're working with people? Yes, based on maybe a diagnosis and things of that nature. But when we talk about everybody's mental health, that everybody has mental health, that's the beauty of counseling, because we're talking about the spirit of who you are, right? And sometimes that spirit's, you know, been damaged because of different traumatic events that's occurred in the person's life. Or the fear that, you know, could happen if I stand up for myself. But it's like, that's where we're trying to get people to be, is to be their best self possible. And that means it's unique to everyone, right? Everybody has their own best self, and that's fine on how you define it and how you look.
Is there any truth to the fact that it's more difficult for men to seek help than there is for women?
Debbie and I joke a lot about the brains. She calls spaghetti brain and waffle brain and things of that nature. She has a whole, she's got a whole routine on that.
I bet she does.
I'll share it later. Okay. Yeah.
But I do believe, you know, how men are wired and how, you know, their stereotypes that men are plagued with. And, you know, part of that is being quiet, being withdrawn, not having feelings, being tough. And I think we've over time, you know, I grew up like, you know, I'm not supposed to cry, pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And that's being a man, right? And I think all of that makes it hard to ask for help then, because I'm supposed to have a whole mantra of being the tough guy, you know? And I mean, that's what we do as a society. And then we make, you know, men are hunters, and then we make women into feelings and nurturers. And so then of course, that would mean you're more willing to talk in that nature. But I do think there's some inherent characteristics between men and women that do make it easier sometimes for women to talk compared to men. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in therapy, that you traditionally or historically see more women than men that go to therapy. You know, our agency is about 55, 45, more women than men, which is low, really. We're about 50-50 when it comes down to it. But yeah.
Okay. And Debbie, given that you are a woman among men in your household, how has that been for you in terms of finding that they've been comfortable with or needed adjusting to addressing the issues that they were facing?
You know, it's so interesting because I'm the oldest of five. I have four younger sisters, and there's a 20-year gap between I'm the oldest and then my youngest sister. And she likes to remind me of that quite often, that there's this big age gap. The first four of us were 8 years apart. And wow. then 11 years later came my youngest sister. And so it's been really interesting having grown up with all females. It said a lot about how my dad worked a lot, because I think he needed to just get away from all the drama that happened constantly. My mom was really good with it. She had just one sister and no brother, so she got the girl thing. But, you know, when my older son was born and then our younger son was born, I just looked at my husband. I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, I have no idea what this is supposed to look like. And then every time when they get older, they'd pass each other and they'd be slapping each other on the arms. And it was always physical, always this touch. And then they'd be talking to me and it'd be this slap on the arm. I'm like, can you guys knock it off? I'm sitting right next to you. Like, just say mom. You don't even have to hit me. It's really nice. But that was like their I don't know what it is really, if that's a guy thing that here, you know, I like you. What is it? What is it?
That's primal communication.
Okay. Well, it drove me crazy. But anyway, that the difference between men and women in my experience communicating, it was so stereotypical. Like at home growing up, it was always, we were always talking. And I'm an introvert. A couple of us are, and then a couple are extroverts in my family, but we were always talking and always engaging and always asking advice and always doing things. So when the kids were growing up, it depended on what was going on. They both would ask, and there both would be situations where they would seek advice or feel like maybe they needed to go to somebody at, like a teacher they trusted or a friend or something. So I was really happy about that. It definitely had a different vibe to it. And I'm all about communication, Charles, you know, we're in communications at SLU exactly. together. So speaking and writing or whatever it is something that's really important to me. So I would always try to encourage the kids to talk about it or to, and my husband would too. We were both very open about that, but with getting help, it was really different situations because my son was young and we knew that something, he needed some counseling. And so we had to decide as parents that needed to happen. I think it really helped him because he is really good about understanding his feelings, knowing himself. Same with our older son, but our older son's more reserved. He's a writer. He doesn't speak so much to us about it, which is his way of doing it. And that's perfectly okay. But when it came time to my husband needing therapy and really getting that under control for him, it was a little more difficult because as an adult, he could make that decision, you know, and he needed to make that decision. And he wanted to, it just was more difficult for him to do it. But once he did, he's all about it. He's all about therapy and counseling and talking. So it's different, I think, in how the approach is done. But I think overall, there's just this innate need for us for our voice to be heard and to know who we are. That I think once people understand that about counseling, that it doesn't mean that you're this failure and you need to have somebody, you know, make you who you are. That's not what it is. Mm-hmm. It's helping you discover better, more about yourself and who you are and your spirit and what's important and where you need to be in life.
Gotcha. You know, one thing that occurs to me as I think about this, and it certainly wouldn't be an episode about mental health if we did not address it, the impact of social media. Now, let's think of it this way. Obviously, this podcast shows up on various platforms. I am not opposed to social media, but I'm also aware of its influence and the way that influence has mushroomed over the years. How do you see it playing a role in how people's mental health is even developed today, since that's what so many people, particularly the younger among us, grow up with, and they make their conclusions about what is good, what is right, who they are, who they should be, based up on what they view and hear and see in terms of social media? And either of you or both of you can certainly feel free to respond to that.
Yeah, for me, you know, as a therapist, when somebody comes in the door and we're going to talk, I'm going to look at three things first: sleep, exercise, and nutrition, right? So when I think about social media, I think there's a couple layers there. So first of all, when I look at sleep, exercise, and nutrition, I think for a fact, technology, phones, play a part of a person's sleep. They lay in bed, they fall asleep looking at Twitter or, you know, Facebook, whatever your preference is. And it allows your mind to be on. So It's easy access and it affects sleep. We know for a fact. We hear it from kids all the time. I've witnessed it myself. Even myself as an adult, like I'll look at the phone before I go to bed. So it affects sleep on a certain level. Even when you get up in the middle of the night to go use the restroom, a lot of people take the phone. Anything happened in the world? What's going on, right? That activates a different part of the brain, which makes it a little bit, you become a little bit more awake, in other words, and it's harder to go back to sleep. Exercise, when you look at that aspect and what social media does, whether it be gaming, whether it be looking and communicating through your phone, you have always something to do other than exercise. And even when people are walking, I mean, what do we always see? People tripping and hurting themselves because they're looking at their phone as they're walking. So those aspects right off the bat, you know, from a person's mental health, I think two major categories of sleep, exercise, and nutrition are immediately affected because of social media. Mm-hmm. For me also, I think, I believe that, you know, kids today are exposed to so much more than what we were. Now, is that good or bad? Sometimes it is good. However, they're exposed to things where they have to have on their conscience, on their mind, that can create anxiety at an earlier age. You know, once upon a time, if there was an accident or something going on in your town or city, you'd have to wait to hear it on the radio or see it on the 10 o'clock news. Now you have immediate access. So a child can be scrolling through something and all of a sudden they witness that and that creates anxiety. My parents aren't home. Maybe they're in that accident and that it just starts going and going. So the immediate access and the immediate gratification, I think, are all parts of, and when we talk about the whole being, right, about mental health, it all affects that at people at an earlier age. Mm-hmm. I'll be quiet for a little while.
Okay. Debbie, you have anything on that?
I do. I think so my younger son, who is quite funny, he thinks, and quite astute on a lot of things, is convinced that I'm addicted to my phone. And I probably am.
Probably.
But yeah, I'm not going to full-fledged say I am, although that is the first step, isn't it, to recovery, so I probably should. But for me, it's how I get my news, and it's how I stay in touch with people. But as my son said, it's really for me just an echo chamber that I'm just talking to the people who agree, and you know, it's easy to not get another side because I know who I want to follow and who I don't based on people's beliefs in different situations. So I think what it can do mental health wise is we can surround ourselves with like-minded thinkers and we might not even know them, you know, where before it was always personal engagement with people and, you know, you knew who the circles were and you worked with them and did stuff with them, where now it's people you don't even know a lot of times through these social media channels. So those connections that used to be more relational are now so much more superficial, but they feel relational because someone might feel the same way you do about a situation. And I think when, you know, just even the however you feel about it, but with Parler and the different platforms that are out there for people to engage in, I think it really fosters a lot of non-real connections. And I think it can be really harmful to a lot of people. But by the same token, there, you know, if you're diagnosed with cancer or your child has ADHD or there's something, there's so many different support platforms that are also part of social media that are very helpful for people. Mm-hmm. So it's, it's that balance, it's that moderation. I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth. And when my kids hear this, they're going to remind me of that. But I do think it plays a big role in our mental health and what we feel good about. And they talk about the, I don't know what part of the brain it is, Tom, where when, you know, like a natural high, when you hit something that makes you feel good, you're going to keep going back to it. And it might not always be a healthy thing to be going back to. So it can go both ways, I think. But I think also we have to really start paying attention to what those pieces are that we're clinging to. And if they're there just to make us feel good or and justify what we think, or if they really are something that is fostering a real relationship instead of just the superficial agreeing with one another.
Okay. You know, listening to you both, and I was jotting down notes as I was listening to what both of you said, I sometimes find myself, when it comes to social media or hell, just the world in general, looking at what's going on around me, and I jotted down some words that I'm going to say to you. And I want you to think of it in the context of this discussion we were just having and how you believe these things have either increased or decreased over time, generationally, as a result of social media and the other influences we see. So those words are anger, desperation, desensitization. It will not come out today. Desensitization. There we got it. Okay. And personal value. So that's four: anger, desperation, desensitization, and personal value. How do you couch those? And, you know, Tom, you can speak certainly in the clinical capacity, I know, in terms of what we're seeing here, because, you know, there are moments, folks, when I just, you know, I'm out there in that universe and you see people who just are going in and you do stop and say, why? What are you doing? Why is this your reaction? You know, some people call them trolls. I have another favorite word for them, but I won't say it. but it's all of these things. Then, of course, as I said, in terms of the desperation, people are willing to do anything. Debbie is unfortunately able to probably see so many things, but I, you know, sometimes repost these things where people are doing horrifically gross things like making spaghetti on a countertop. And I'm just like, is this the only way that you, you know, have to live your life?
Please no.
Yeah. And the, you know, thing is, you know, people stop now with their phones when they see literal murders happening and they will record it. So that's desensitized. And then, of course, people don't feel like they matter unless someone else says they do. So those categories, how do you speak to that in terms of mental health? I know that I protect myself because the moment that somebody comes for me, I send them home. If you say one thing on my social media that is untoward, you are blocked, you're gone forever. A lot of people don't do that because they want to have followers. So how do you all feel about those categories and speak to them somewhat?
Yeah, well, that is a very thought-provoking question. I do like this.
Well, thank you.
when you think about social media, right? And yeah, the people have different reasons. You know, they try to get more followers and all that. But there's social media has created this ability to. It used to be we referred to email as keyboard warriors. You know, you could fire off an email, and you know, but it'd be with people that you'd be working with, and there'd be consequences to it. And now with social media, there's really no consequence to however you talk to people and to whatever mood you're in that day. And I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, emotional regulation or dysregulation, depending on, you know, what's happened to you. And so I think a lot of times with the anger part, that people say there's no consequences. So I can say however I want and it's okay because there's no face really. Mm-hmm. Maybe you see a picture, but there's no face. So I can say whatever I want to you. And then, you know, for whatever reason, maybe about power, maybe about control and things of that nature. And then, you know, I think that leads in a little bit to the desensitizing of people. I had to say it really slow because that's a word I have a hard time with as well too. usually Debbie finishes that word for me. And when you're desensitized, I even find it in myself, right? So I worked in, you know, some really high stressful situations over the years, and things did not affect me, you know, because I built a wall around that. And so even what I watch now on TV or movies or whatever, right? For me to be engaged, it's got to be pretty severe, you know. Not that I'm, you know, looking at a bunch of gory, bloody movies and all that, but like to keep my interest, like it just can't be PG, like, you know. And I think it's because of my experiences, not only through work, but also what we're exposed to. Like you were saying, people will film a murder, people will film death. And it's more important getting that on video than actually watching it with your own eyes. You're watching it through your lens. And so,
or trying to stop it.
Or yes, exactly. You know, and that's more important. And so they can watch it again, you know, and watch it over and over again. And then you become more desensitized to the actual event. So I'll stop there. But I think those two things for me, like when you ask that question, they relate. But it really truly is about our exposure to so many different aspects of society.
Okay.
I also think when we're talking about anger, I think social media, just by its very nature, gives people a platform to use their voice. And I think there are a lot of people who we don't always have the, as my mom would always say, couth. Just don't have the couth or the awareness of how words can truly be weapons and used that way. So whether it's bullying, which happens on and off social media, which we know, or just thinking that someone is so incredibly stupid that you're going to make sure that you're going to, you know, help them see the right way. There are so many topics out there right now that just automatically saying the word brings about anger in people. And I think social media is a platform where, like Tom said, there aren't consequences, you know? And so it's easy to spew all of that off, no matter who it's targeting or who it's hurting. And it makes that person feel better. And like, I know for myself, there are so many social justice issues that just I get so riled up about,
and
it's, I mean, Charles, I know, it's very surprising. It's a fault, whatever you want to call it, that I've been working on for a long time. But I can't keep quiet. And so I know that things that I have posted on Facebook can really be seen as extremely angry, at maybe a certain person who's, you know, a leader and not doing what needs to be done or whatever it is. So I think it allows people to feel angry and be angry. And I think sometimes it's perpetuated by that, where we're not processing it, we're just spewing it, and it riles us up even more, and then people respond, and then we get another reaction, and it's very reactionary, and versus respond,
right.
Responding. For desensitization, you know, I'll chuckle when Tom was talking about movies, because we all, like at work, we'll talk about different shows or watching on Netflix or different movies, and I'll start one that Tom might suggest, and I'm like, oh my God, I cannot. This is so violent. Like, I cannot. I don't like blood and, you know, killing. And so I'll maybe watch one episode and I'm like, okay, I'm done. I'm just not going to watch this anymore. And so, like, my kids, well, my younger son especially, makes brutal fun of the fact that I like Young Sheldon on Thursday nights. And so, like, back in the old days when you didn't have VCRs, and you could record it, we would always just, there were certain shows that were our favorites as a family, and we'd watch them at that time on that night. And that's how young Sheldon is for me. Like, I try to carve out 7 to 7:30 every Thursday to just sit on the sofa and watch it and not record it. But if there's a ball game, I get booted out, or if there's something else. So my son and his friends think it's hilarious that that's my favorite kind of go-to show, is something funny, simple and innocent and non-gory.
Well, you know, everybody's
so
got
don't
their
think
something.
I have had that desensitization yet.
Yeah, and everybody's got their something. So, you know, there's no judgment here. So that's fine. It makes me think about something else, though. I know that it's collectively called PC culture, right? Everybody is up in their feelings, as folks like to say. However, there is a separation to the extent that where feelings really do apply, people don't appreciate them, right? So people say things without understanding their impact on other people because everyone's not the same. On the other hand, there are some people who lead with their feelings to such an extent that it's all that they can do. I don't know how many times a week I have to tell people feelings are not facts, right? So you have to give yourself a window to understand what my intention is, and not just focus upon what your feelings are about it. Can you speak to those two categories? Because it burns my toast, you know, when someone says to me, you know, well, you made me feel this way. And I'm like, no, I didn't. I have no control over what you feel. You have every control over how you react to what I'm saying or doing. But to understand it, you need to know what my intention was. Now, clearly, there are examples where people are intending to do harm. We can pretty much discern those for ourselves. But where people are so caught up in what they feel and they listen to respond versus listening to learn, how do we, from a mental health perspective, keep all of us, to the extent possible, on an even keel so that we're not doing that to each other?
Yeah, it comes back to personal responsibility, right? It comes back to being a good human being as well, too. And the L word, as you said, listening. And that's where, to me, it starts. And so, but listening to hear the other person's point of view compared to listening just to hear what that person has to say and then and spit something back at them. And from a mental health perspective, right, it's about opening yourself up to being willing to hear another person's point of view, to gain knowledge and to understand. And that's hard to do, you know, and what I find even in the workplace, sometimes you have to be so strategic and actually have to define that for people. You know, I've worked within teams, you know, my whole career in social services, and sometimes it's a very, you know, just a few people, or sometimes it's a large amount of people. But I think you have to actually teach or to present that in a way like we have to, and it sounds so basic, right? We have to listen to each other. And by listening to each other means this. And I'm going to ask you to reflect on that before you respond. And so at times I think, you know, business as well as nonprofits has to have that ability to actually be that purposeful. Because when you look at turnover, right? When you look at trying to train new staff coming in and out, employees coming in and out, it takes a lot of money to do that, and it takes a lot of time. So why not take the team you have and try to make them into better human beings? And to the point of saying we're all in control of our own choices and our own feelings. And you're right. Just because you didn't make that person feel that way, they chose to feel that way. And there's those choices and that language. And I'm a big proponent in that employee, and that it's emotional intelligence is a lot of it what I'm describing, but it's about taking the time to be proactive in that sense, from that regard.
Great. Thank
you. I think too that, you know, we all carry our baggage. We all have stuff that, whatever it is, over the course of our lives that we've dealt with and what we've had. So there are always going to be things that we're more sensitive to and more sensitive about. And it sometimes is really hard to separate the emotion from the speak or from, you know, the interactions with people. And especially now, I just feel like today, and I don't know if it seems more so because of COVID and people being isolated and needing to feel more. There's something that just seems a little bit different now too. That when you're away from people and not interacting, it's kind of a sense of not loss of feeling, but it's just different. And so are people feeling more angry and are people feeling more on edge and more sensitive to different life experiences that are going on? You know, there are so many milestones that people haven't been able to experience. I think about the kids who graduated last year from high school, and there was no ceremony for that. And they didn't have, you know, the typical pieces that go through things. And so is grief part of what we feel with different things? And I think, like, I'm focusing now just on this year, but it's always been, I mean, we've always been sensitive to things. When I was a kid growing up, I cried all the time. That was like my reaction. When I got angry, I would cry. It was just the immediate thing. And I know it drove my family crazy because that would be the first reaction. But after I would think about it and then think, okay, well, that was stupid, or that, why did I cry? Or why was I, not that it was, just that's where I was in life. I think, you know, not crying now, not having that be my reaction, but sometimes feeling angry or impatient or just disgusted with something. Why do I feel it? Why do I feel that it's a personal, not attack, but a personal insult? And what is that? Is it my ego? Is it that this person doesn't know what they're talking about? And so going back to what you're saying, Charles, what's the context? What's the intention? What is the conversation centered around? And am I feeling heard? Or like, I can't stand to be dismissed. That is just something that I have never been good about. And so am I feeling insulted that you're not listening to what I have to say? Mm-hmm. So I think there's so much that we carry with us. I don't know if there's an easy answer to have people respond a certain way or learn a certain way or do things, just because we all come in with so many different things, spaghetti brain or waffle brain, whatever it's going to be. And I have to disclose that came from friends, from their therapist. This is not something that I developed on my own. And Tom, I think I was pretty clear about that when we talked.
Fair enough. I've got a couple of more questions before we wrap up here. The thing that I think is important as I listen to both of you is, you know, I've heard the statements and how this comes down to personal responsibility. In my own life, and as I've spoken to many people, including you all, when I've been on your podcast, I'm a huge proponent of constant work on self. Part of that intensive self-care means taking care of self mentally, physically, as Tom was saying earlier. For me, that translates into being so brutally honest with myself that I just don't let myself slip. And that's not meaning that I don't love myself or appreciate myself. It just means that I don't let myself get away with the bull. I think that if you could speak just a little bit on the importance of constantly working and reworking on yourself as you identify who you are, because it's an evolutionary process that leads to revolutionary results, but you've got to constantly do the work. Speak on that for just a bit.
I mean, man, that's it's daily. It's got to be this daily regimen of work, you know, and I compare it to this. If I want to have big bulging biceps, right, I'm in the gym as much as possible. And then when I and I start developing it, you know, and I'm it's looking good, you know, so visually I can see how big that bicep is looking and I'm feeling good and everything. And then I stop. I stop for 3 months. That will not be the same looking bicep. It's just not going to be looking the same. And as you get older, it gets even harder. And it's the same thing with our mind and with our soul and with our spirit. If we don't have that daily regimen of addressing and being honest with yourself of your strengths and your weaknesses, right? And then what am I going to do? If I'm not happy about something, what am I going to do to change that? And what are the keys to that? Yes, there are roadblocks along the way. So what's my plan for that specific roadblock that gets in the way? It's got to be a daily process, and doesn't mean you have to spend all day long doing it. It just means that it's got to be part of your schedule of that day. I mean, the day is 24 hours. Hopefully we're getting a good 8 hours sleep. So there's plenty of time to take 30 minutes. Sometimes it's 15 minutes, but to take that amount of time and devote it to your overall emotional health.
Great. Thank you, Tom. Debbie?
Yeah, I agree. I know that for me, if I don't have my morning time that is just mine, that I can spend reflecting on something from the day before or anticipating and preparing for something that day, and in prayer, like that's a huge piece for me. I can't, I feel really off on those days that I haven't spent that time that I've needed in prayer. Not that I do it well. There are a lot of times when I'm just sitting there and I'm like, okay, God, I don't even know what I need today. So, you know, just give it to me. But for me, and I can't speak for everybody at all, of course, or even for everybody in my family, but finding what works for people, whether it's exercise in the morning. You know, I know a lot of people who start their day with exercise and it's awesome for them, or reading or reflecting or praying or eating or, you know, whatever it is, to carve that time out at whatever time of day works for you, that requires us to really think about what our choices are and why we do what we do, and not just to think, okay, well, yesterday, yeah, I fed the dog and I took the dog for a walk, or I did this or I did that. It's not so much about doing, but more about being.
Right.
I find that to be much more helpful in finding ways to improve all the many faults and, you know, and struggles that I still, you know, we're all about the same age, but, you know, having that
27,
those experiences. Yeah. I think it's important to just be able to take the time for yourself to do what you need to do to make yourself a better person.
Exactly.
Is really important.
Mental health month. Mental Health Awareness Month is the month of May. But beyond that, for those who are in the immediate area who want to access services at St. Louis Counseling, go ahead. And it's not even a shameless plug. It's just a plug. Tell people how to reach you.
Can I do it, since you do it all the time, Tom, on podcast? Okay. So it's St. Louis Counseling. We have a website, stlouiscounseling.org. That's Saint spelled out. We are on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Look for us there. Or you can call us directly at 314-544-3800. You can make appointments. We have psychiatry, we have counseling. So if you're feeling that you really need to do something for yourself and mental health is the piece that is really going to help you with that, please give us a call and get the help that really makes a difference.
Absolutely.
In your life.
I'd like to thank Tom Duff and Debbie Dugan for joining us today. And I must tell you, they are two of the very best people. St. Louis Counseling does a fantastic job. And I want you all to remember, beyond the month of May, mental health matters. Thank you, Tom and Debbie.
Thank you, Charles.
Take care. Enjoy your Saturday.
You too.
Bye now.
Bye.